Hello, 你好，你好。
Don't leave just yet, you're still on the right podcast. Welcome to another episode of The Hidden Island.
你好，欢迎来到我们的节目《隐藏的岛屿》。你好，欢迎来到我们的节目《隐藏的岛屿》。
Hi, I'm Camelia Nguyen, and I'm the Communications and Fundraising Coordinator of the PEI Museum and Heritage Foundation. And you just heard Trista Jiali Liang, our former podcast producer assistant and a recent UPEI graduate. Thank you so much for the lovely greetings in Mandarin and Cantonese, Trista.
My pleasure, Cam. Thanks for having me here.
Today, Trista and I are here to discuss the history of Chinese Islanders.And as a first-generation Vietnamese immigrant to Canada, I've always been fascinated about the journey of folks from the Asian diaspora to PEI. And as part of my work with the PEI Museum and Heritage Foundation right now, I've stumbled upon the book called Chinese Islanders, Making a Home in the New World by Dr. Hung Min Chiang, which really inspired us to do an episode about the history of the Chinese community on PEI.Talking about Asian communities on the island, many people often think that they're mostly new immigrants that arrived in the past 50 years or so. And that was also my thought before reading this book, because after all, why PEI, right? British Columbia and Ontario are often the first that come in mind due to their, you know, proximity to Asia and longstanding Asian communities. But to my surprise, there were folks of Chinese descent on PEI since as early as 1850. And so that's why we are going to walk through the 174 years of Chinese heritage on PEI altogether in this episode. And my co-host Trista, who's originally from China, has a lot of interesting things to share. Trista, do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes, of course. Hello, everyone. My name is Jiali Liang. I usually go by Trista in Canada. I'm from the south of China. I've been living in PEI for almost 5 years with lots of fantastic experiences and memories. I know that we have some early Chinese immigrants in our community who immigrated to Canada 20 or 30 years ago. Until I came across Chinese Islanders, this book last year, the long history of Chinese immigration to Canada blew my mind.I realized that it is something people seldom notice or pay attention to. I think it is a great chance to share the history and share more insights of Chinese community. When I was working on this episode last year, I had a chance to interview different people and learn so much about their hidden stories and interesting experiences working with the Chinese community. I can't wait to share them with you.So, let's kick off with a fun fact. Did you know that 1 in 6 people living on the island speaks a language at home that isn't English or French?
That's me! I speak Vietnamese, and I didn't know the statistics beforehand, but that's very believable considering the diversity of PEI.
Right.
But I don't think Vietnamese is a popular first language on the island, though.
Yeah, we know English and French are the official languages in Canada, but we still get 4% of our population speaking Mandarin.And you know what? Mandarin Chinese isn't the only Chinese dialect you can hear in PEI. There are many people speaking Cantonese as well.
So Trista, you can speak both Cantonese and Mandarin, right?
Yes, I do. And actually, Cantonese is my mother language. I can speak both Cantonese and Mandarin because Cantonese is a major dialect in my region, and Mandarin is the official language we usually speak and use at school and workplace.
That's amazing. And how are the two languages different from each other?
People usually assume that these two languages only differ in the accent. However, their differences are similar to the ones among English and some languages spoken in Scandinavia.The use of words and tones of these two languages are very different.
Mm-hmm.
Cantonese is a dialect in my province, and it is one of the official languages in Hong Kong and Macau. We have 8 main dialects, including Cantonese in China. Aside from Cantonese, Hakka is another popular Chinese dialect on the island.
Well, I really learned something new today. It's so amazing to think that languages that are considered foreign here by many locals andHonestly, me, have actually been around for over 100 years. And who were the first people that brought the Chinese language and culture to the island?
According to Dr. Jiang's book, the first Chinese islander was Louisa Maria Hooper. A woman came from Macau who was half Chinese and half Portuguese. She and her family settled in Charlottetown in 1850. Oh. It was not a straightforward discovery, though. She was discovered when Dr. John came across the diary of Harry John Condell. Condell kept his diary from 1854 to 1909. Mm-hmm. In it, he mentioned visiting the Hooper family. This prompted Dr. John to dig deeper and then discovered her record in the 1881 Canada Census, which listed the birthplace as China.
I find that so fascinating because you mentioned that Dr. Jiang found out about her by chance, right? Yeah. And obviously the name Louisa Maria Hooper definitely does not come off Chinese
exactly.
In any way. And Dr. Jiang mentioned a variety of reasons why there was so little record about her, because she was not a business owner. She came to PEI when Chinese immigration wasn't yet common. And mm-hmm. as a woman in the 19th century who most likely was a homemaker, there was probably little documentation of her private life. And this huge revelation was made by accident, as Dr. Jiang mentioned, but I really need to pay him my respect for the extensive research that he conducted. Yeah. Who would expect to find out about a Chinese person in a white man's diary?
Right.
And most would not consider this relevant to Chinese history, and Dr. Jiang really, really went the extra mile on this one.
And you know what? Dr. Jiang also found out from baptism records in the public archives and research office that the Hoopers had 9 surviving children. All were born on PEI. So, to any Hoopers on the island listening, you might actually have Chinese ancestry.
If you have any Hoopers in your family tree, you might want to get an ancestry test today.
So, when we're talking about the history of Chinese immigrants, it's crucial to shed light on the 1880s. A significant chapter in the history of Chinese labor in Canada. Back in 1881, British Columbia was right on the cusp of getting hooked up by a new railway to the rest of the Dominion. But there were not enough people to do the work, especially since BC's population was just around 35,000, and most of the men were already busy in other industries.
Yeah, the Canadian Pacific Railway.
So, to solve the labor shortage problem, they brought in Chinese workers, a bunch from California, and some straight from the hearts of China itself. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the kicker. These hardworking folks took on the tough job of building the western sections of the railway, which had the most challenging and dangerous terrain. By the end of 1882, out of 9,000 railway workers, an astonishing 6,500 were Chinese Canadians.
Wow.
So let's take a moment to talk about how differently they were treated and paid. Picture this. Chinese laborers were making just $1 a day, having to cover their own food and gear expenses. Meanwhile, others received $1.50 to $2.50 daily and even got their basic needs covered. To top it off, the most privileged jobs, like dealing with explosive nitroglycerin, usually fell on the shoulders of Chinese Canadian. Sadly, a lot of them met their fates through accidents. Brutal weather, sickness, and not getting enough to eat.
It's really saddening to hear, but what I'm hearing are straight facts of how Chinese workers were treated differently, in a bad way, mm-hmm. compared with workers of other heritages. So, considering the sacrifice they made, we would expect that they would at least be fairly compensated. But that was unfortunately not how it worked, and that's the reality of racism in Canada in the early 1880s.
Chinese workers made a huge contribution, but when the railway was completed, they were totally left out of the big national celebrations. I was reading several articles about this, and in the photo of the ceremonial last bike moment, not a single Chinese Canadian worker was in sight.
Can you describe that photo a little bit more? What was in there?
Yeah, so it's a photo that shows Donald Smith, the Baron Strathcona, and Mont Royal driving in the last bike. Donald Smith is in the center of the frame, surrounded by at least 50 men, you know, or Caucasian men.
I think that's an extremely powerful reminder of the injustice that Chinese people faced in the early days. Just imagine putting in all the hard work, blood, sweat, and tears just to be discredited in every way. They didn't get something as simple as a photo op. And while there has been a lot of progress and people have become more welcoming now, we right. should not forget that there's a long history of anti-Asian racism in Canada, not something that just started with COVID-19. And the Chinese community was not the only Asian group that faced discrimination in the past. Let's not forget about the Komagata Maru incident when a ship carrying Southeast Asian immigrants was refused entry to Canada, or the Japanese-Canadian internment where Canadians of Japanese descent were forced by the Canadian government to leave their homes and nearly all their possessions and live in camps.
Oh no.
But those are stories for another podcast episode. We just learned about the early history of Chinese immigrants in Canada. Mm-hmm. So what about on PEI?
We will get to that in a minute. But first, let's look at another significant page of the past, the Chinese Immigration Act. After the Canadian Pacific Railway was completed in 1885, the Chinese Immigration Act was passed. Back then, every person of Chinese origin had to pay $50 to enter Canada, and they were the only ethnic group in Canada that was forced to pay such a head tax. The head tax eventually went up to $500 per person in 1903 and continued until 1923.
Well, that's like 10 times the original head tax. And
yeah.
to put that into perspective, $500 in 1903 is equal to around $18,000
wow.
today, considering inflation. And that's a huge amount that not a lot of families can afford.
Yeah, and that's why Chinese men outnumber women back in the days. The head tax was so expensive that many men had to come to Canada alone.
Our executive director, Matthew McRae, also wrote an article about this during his time with the Canadian Museum for Human Rights. He had an interview with Dr. Henry Yu, who is a professor of history at the University of British Columbia, whose grandfather was one of the last head taxpayers in Canada. And in the case of Dr. Yu's grandfather, he arrived in the country just before the Canadian government passed the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1923, which banned Chinese immigration to Canada almost completely. And only four classes of Chinese immigrants were allowed, and that includes diplomats, Canadian-born children, authorized merchants, and university students. But considering most Chinese immigrants were laborers, many of their family members back in China did not qualify, and this policy literally tore families apart. And in fact, only 15 Chinese immigrants were accepted in Canada when the Exclusion Act was in place. Dr. Yu shared that his grandfather did not meet his own daughter, aka Dr. Yu's mother, for the first time in 1965. And this was far, far after the Exclusion Act was demolished in 1947. It's even more heartbreaking when you realize that Dr. Yu's story is a rare one with a happy ending. Most of the early Chinese immigrants to Canada ended up growing old alone, leaving their wives and children behind.
Canada formally apologized in 2006, and $20,000 in redress was offered by the governments of Canada to each surviving individual who had paid the head tax. Lots of reconciliation efforts was made by the governments, including funding for community historical recognition programs.
Last year, I had the chance to visit the Canadian Museum of Immigration in Halifax, and they had an incredible exhibit that showed the immigration experience of many Chinese families in the Maritimes. And last year also marked 100 years since the Chinese Exclusion Act was passed.
Right.
It's been more than a century now, but the evidence is still there. And the trauma is still devastating for generations of Chinese Canadians. I'm so glad to see that there's work done to make sure this part of history is not forgotten and that we have Dr. Hung Min Chiang's documentations for islanders to never forget.
Yeah. What about PEI? Were there many head taxpayers on the island?
Good question. Numbers were small, but significant. Dr. Chiang notes that after Louisa Maria Hooper, the first Chinese on the island, arrived in the summer of 1891, there were two men who arrived from Halifax to set up a laundry business. But business was slow and they did not stay very long. And then more Chinese immigrants came and went in the 1890s, and by 1901 there were 4 Chinese recorded as living on the island. All of them lived in Charlottetown and immigrated to Canada in their 20s or 30s, working as laundrymen, making around $150 per year. Keep in mind that the head tax was $100 at this point, and it was not uncommon for Chinese immigrants to take on debt for their voyage to Canada. So they were working tough jobs for very little money, with not much left after sending money home and paying off their debt. Yeah. As if their life was not hard enough, a proposal for a special provincial tax on top of the federal head tax for Chinese was put forth in the same year. And seems like there was no evidence whether it was seriously discussed at the legislature, but the fact that something like this was even debated was very disappointing. Luckily, there were lots of progressive islanders that expressed support for the few Chinese immigrants, and one newspaper editorial back then said, and I'm gonna quote it word by word, "So far, but few Chinese have come to this province, and their intrusion in very limited numbers has created very little disturbance in any walk of life. Those who have come have been industrious, peaceable, law-abiding citizens, and apparently about as honest as the Christian people among whom they live." So at least there was some hope for the early Chinese islanders in what Dr. Chiang said was an otherwise difficult environment.
So, in addition to laundromats, did the early Chinese settlers work in other fields?
Hand laundry was a popular one because Canadian laws excluded Chinese people from a lot of professions, and laundromat requires little capital or English proficiency to start. And it was not only until 1915 or so when the first Chinese-owned restaurant called Café La Grande was opened in Charlottetown. This paved the way for other cafe-style restaurants across the island, and most of them served Western-style food and some westernized Chinese food. In Summerside, Jim Lang of the New World Cafe was one that was well-loved by islanders for his generosity. He was said to often let locals eat on credit and even offered free meals to police officers in the 1940s.
That's nice.
Oh, talking about Chinese chefs in PEI, did you know that the oldest living person in North America was a Chinese islander?
Wow, really?
Well, there's Jim Ho of Charlottetown, who passed away on October 16, 1977, which is just 1 month short of his 112th birthday.
Wow.
He was born in China in 1865, and he emigrated to Canada in 1900 when the head tax was $100. Ho was a fun-loving, free spirit and traveled all over Canada, but he eventually settled in Charlottetown, and he was working as a chef at the Roxy restaurant into his 90s. He was known for making delicious wonton skins, and he was said to still be doing his own shopping and daily chores until at least the age of 108.
Wow, that's incredible. So Jim Ho lived through the 19th and almost the entire 20th century.
Yes, he did.
Like, it is so incredible to imagine all the historical moments that happened in his lifetime. And in Charlottetown, there's a place called Canton Cafe with a pretty interesting backstory. It was founded in 1970 by George Lee and Ken Wong. Serving both Chinese and Canadian cuisine, Jin Ho would have been 105 years old at that time.
Yes, the Canton Cafe. Listeners, many of you would probably be familiar with the Canton Cafe on Queen Street. It's pretty much a downtown Charlottetown landmark at this point. And last year, we shared the story of Canton to the PEI Museum and Heritage Foundation's social media, and the post was flooded with islanders sharing their memories. If you're not following us yet, we are on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn with the handle Heritage PEI, and we share bite-sized stories of PEI heritage, so make sure to check us out. Anyway, lots of folks had memories of ordering egg rolls at Canton Cafe after a night out at Charlottetown's former nightclubs.
It's so lovely to see that the iconic Canton Cafe still lives in the memories of many islanders.
Right.
Especially through the hardship that Chinese immigrants first experienced with the Exclusion Act. Seeing that Chinese-owned businesses still thrived and made a lasting impact on islanders' lives is so powerful. I have to admit that I did not feel grateful until I learned of the challenges my people faced in the past. Living in PEI for almost 5 years, I received so much kindness from the people around me. I'm very lucky. I did not actually encounter any racism or hardship in Canada, even during the pandemic, which was the most difficult time. So I deeply appreciate the diversity and inclusiveness of the society in Charlottetown.
Trista, now that we've paddled through the hardest part of the voyage of Chinese Islanders, let's talk about the now. While the Chinese population in the early 1900s experienced very slow growth due to systemic racism such as the head tax and the Exclusion Act, the Chinese are still one of the most tight-knit and resilient ethnic community on PEI. In addition to the descendants of early Chinese settlers, the island also welcomes many new islanders of Chinese heritage, like Trista, that came here to work and study. Yeah. Do you have any stories or familiarity with the current Chinese community on the island?
Yeah, of course. As our community grew, the need for formal associations became apparent. This has led to the creation of various Chinese groups that foster unity and cultural celebration. I remember attending a few social events that the UPEI Chinese Students and Scholars Association hosted in my first year. It was a great platform to meet other Chinese students and scholars, make friends, and celebrate our festivals. It made my transition here so much smoother. I should also mention the student body of UPEI on its own. It's such a diverse community with more than 1,600 international students from 90 countries. At UPEI, we have Dr. Jerry Wang from the International Student Office, who is a Chinese Islander that's been of great support to international students who have made PEI their home away from home. I had the pleasure to interview him for this podcast, and let's hear what he has to share about living and working on the island.
Hi there, my name is Jerry Wang. I'm the director of the Recruitment and First Year Advisement Office at UPEI. The office also included the International Student Office here on the campus. I do have some interesting stories and experiences after we moved here to PEI. So back in 2006, when we moved here, it's a very new place to us, and it was not very diverse back then. There were not very many people from other parts of the world. So I remember one time, I think it was probably at the superstore, we were getting some groceries, and I remember a little child staring at me. I was just walking and the child just staring and looking at me. I'm pretty sure it's because I have black hair. I look different than a lot of other residents here on the island. So that was very interesting. I noticed with the years going by, from 2006, more and more immigrants or international students are moving to PEI, so it was getting more diverse, and all the point to now, which is, you know, PEI Charlottetown is as diverse as a lot of places in Canada. So I think those are the highlights of my experiences here.
It definitely takes some adjustments for folks moving to PEI for the first time. I encounter many challenges as an international student living in a new country when I first came here. Language is one big challenge, at least for me. Adjusting to both the language and the academic culture is very daunting at first. I was so shy to use English to communicate with others at first because I was not confident with my accents or language skills. And later, with the encouragement and practice with my friends I made at university, I finally understood that people could understand me even if I could not speak good English. The action you took to express yourself is the key in the communication.
Trista, don't even worry about that. Your English is absolutely perfect.
Thank you.
But I can totally feel you there. I'm a permanent resident now, but this time 2 years ago, I was an international student that experienced the exact same thing. Right. It is so scary to have to uproot and move to a country on the other side of the globe with no connections and very little understanding of the culture and the language.
Exactly.
And I think we are very fortunate that we live in a very welcoming version of Canada, PEI now, and mm-hmm. not 100 years ago.
Right.
Not to say there's no modern day racism, especially after the pandemic, but like you said, we now have encouragement. We have islanders to practice English with. Yeah. We have an inclusive community that welcomes and appreciates our presence. If you're homesick or lonely, at least there's FaceTime, and mm-hmm. home is just a flight away, an expensive flight. But still, this was not the case for the early Chinese Canadians and Chinese Islanders a century ago. And I want to once again pay my respect to the early Asian immigrants who sacrificed themselves and left everything behind, knowing that they might not ever see their loved ones again, to board a ship and land in a foreign country that was once not the most welcoming. The courage they took to make a home in the new world in the face of extreme adversity is commendable.
The diversity of Chinese community on the island is also reflected in the religious practices of our Chinese community. For example, the Chinese Christian Church here provides services in Chinese. The church is called the Providence Evangelical International Church, and similar to other PEI churches, they offer Sunday services, Sunday schools, and group Bible study classes.
Another mention would be the Great Enlightenment Buddhist Institute Society. And the Buddhist monks are very active with community involvement. They have hosted various fundraisers, bake sales, community fridge meals, food boxes delivery, and the list goes on. Oral Corner Historic Village, one of our Museum and Heritage Foundation sites, also received help from the monks after the Hurricane Fiona. And we have Kevin McLean, the site director of Orwell, on the line here. So let's listen to his experience with the Buddhist volunteers. Hi, Kevin.
My name is Kevin McLean. I grew up in Kinross, which is about a quarter of a mile from the Orwell Corner Historic Village. I started working there after I graduated from Holland College. They came out to Orwell on three different occasions with large groups of Buddhist monks, probably around 50 in total in each group.
That's incredible. How was your experience of working alongside such a dedicated group of volunteers?
They brought handsaws, chainsaws, broke up into different groups and worked throughout the village cleaning up the tree debris and piling all the brush. And whenever they were there, they would have lunch and they'd offer us staff to sit down and have lunch with them. And they were very generous.
Sounds like a staff at Orwell got a treat. Thanks for sharing, Kevin, and big thanks to the Buddhist volunteers for their incredible support.
Another group that is often mistaken with the monks is the Great Wisdom Buddhist Institute, which is led by the Buddhist nuns. Similar to the monks, the nuns also dedicated themselves to community services. They are known for hosting educational mindfulness workshops, as well as food and clothing donations.
Both organizations have been the focus of land use concerns around their purchases of property here on the island.
Right.
And land use is something very near and dear to the hearts of islanders, given our small size. It's worth noting that questions around the Buddhist institution's land acquisitions are part of a much larger and very important conversation happening about land use policies and regulations on PEI. And these type of land use issues go all the way back to the 1700s in this province. The history of land use and misuse on the island really deserves its own podcast episode, but that's for another time.
In this episode, we focused on Chinese immigration to Canada and Prince Edward Island. But we need to acknowledge that, like so many others, Chinese immigrants are settlers on indigenous land.
As we conclude in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge that the land upon which this podcast produced is unceded Mi'kmaq territory. We pay our respect to the indigenous Mi'kma'ki people who have occupied this island for over 12,000 years, past, present, and future. It's been a terrific season, and we're all so grateful for our listeners' support. We've recently been featured in the list of 10 best PEI podcasts by FeedPost. Thank you so, so much again for all the love. We wouldn't have made it without the generous support of the Confederation Center of the Arts, the Provincial Credit Union, and the Grey Group. We'd also like to extend our sincere thanks to Food Island PEI, Water Prince Corner Shop, and Upstreet Craft Brewing Company for their in-kind support, and to Adam Gallant for the iconic theme music that's been guiding us into each podcast episode since day one. The Hidden Island podcast produced by the PEI Museum and Heritage Foundation. We are a not-for-profit that works to protect, preserve, and promote island heritage, and we can only make it with the generous support of islanders. If you like this podcast and would like to support our work to produce more educational content like this, please consider making a donation or becoming a member. More information is available on peimuseum.ca. Thank you again for joining me as a co-host today, Trista. Do you want to say goodbye to our audience?
Sure, thanks for having me here today. 感谢你的收听，我们下一期节目再见。感谢你的收听，我们下一期节目再见。
And that's Mandarin and Cantonese for thank you for listening. See you in the next season of the Hidden Island Podcast.